The following recording is of a platform address presented to the Ethical Society of St. Louis by Kate Lovelady, leader of the Ethical Society of St. Louis. Entitled Lives of the Ethical Saints, Galileo, it was recorded live on 11 November 2007.
Good morning, everyone. First, I want to start by thanking Brian Vandenberg and Jeffrey Kurtzman for their adult ed class, which just finished, unfortunately, for many of you, which was on medieval to modern thought, because it was their brief mentions of Galileo that inspired me to do this platform, although as the disclaimer goes, all errors are my own. And in that vein of disclaimers, I also want to say that I had a really hard time keeping what I wanted to say today to 30 minutes or so. So in case things whiz by you that you want to question or correct, I will be staying around afterward for a talk back here. So second, what does it mean to be a saint in our tradition? I titled today's talk, Lives of the Ethical Saints, and hopefully there will be more, but this is our first one. We're looking at Galileo as an ethical saint. And what does that mean in an ethical society? Buddhism as bodhisattvas, people who have become enlightened about something and who become teachers. Some forms of Judaism speak of tzaddikim, or righteous ones. Sainthood in Catholicism requires miracles or martyrdom, so clearly I'm using saint in the more common term of someone who models the positive values of a tradition and who suffers or sacrifices for their ideals. Which leads me to Galileo. If you know anything about Galileo, it's probably that he challenged the prevailing belief of his time that the earth was the center of the universe, that he was indicted by the Catholic Church for this belief, and that he backed down. And that was pretty much all that I knew until a few weeks ago. But in finding out more about this classic confrontation between science and orthodoxy, I discovered that there are many lessons that we can learn from Galileo's life. Galileo's era is now generally known as the Counter-Reformation, and it was a time in which the church was taking up the challenges that Martin Luther and the new Protestant sects were bringing. The church sought to shore up its power and its authority through internal reforms, through warfare, and through stamping out heretical beliefs, those that contradicted official church teachings, using the office of the Inquisition. Now, at the time, the accepted picture of reality was actually based on an ancient pagan, Aristotle, whose text had been rediscovered recently. Aristotle supported the use of reason to understand the world. But he didn't so much support the use of the senses to understand the world, because our senses can be tricked or led astray. He and Plato agreed kind of on this. And that seems reasonable. The senses can lead us astray. But the problem is that if we don't check our theories against the natural world, against something empirical out there, our reason can come up with lots of very clever-sounding but untrue ideas. And Brian shared a quote in the class from a contemporary of Galileo's who reasoned that since there are seven openings to the human head, your eyes, your nose, your ears, your mouth, there must be seven planets. Of course. And we can argue that such reasoning is not really reasoning because it defies the laws of logic. But even so, today we're finding more and more through empirical research that nature is much weirder than we could ever reason. So reasoning correctly requires logic, and it also requires correct information. Computer programmers have used the term garbage in, garbage out to describe what happens when you put incorrect information into a program. And I looked up that phrase on Wikipedia, and it says that the newer version is garbage in, gospel out. Which is not meant to be an anti-religious phrase. It actually means just that we tend to accept whatever a computer tells us as true, though we don't know how that information was created or whether the initial data that were input were correct. And Wikipedia itself is a good example, because I really have no idea whether the phrase garbage in, gospel out is this widespread phrase that I had just never heard of before, or whether some person thought it up and put it in Wikipedia to spread it around. In this case, I think it doesn't matter, because it's just an interesting phrase for us to think about. But especially now that you know that I look up things on Wikipedia, I hope that you will never take anything I say as gospel. Not that you did before, from what I can tell. So what did Aristotle's reason tell him about the world? Well, he surmised that heavenly bodies, meaning the sun and these stars that were brighter and acted differently and that we now know as planets, he thought that these were attached to perfect invisible bubbles that rotated around the Earth, if you can imagine that. And by the way, he did think the Earth was round, so points for Aristotle. And all these rotating spheres were put in motion by what he called the prime mover, which was sort of outside and kind of gave everything its start. The universe was a perfect system that had always existed and that would always exist without change. Earth was the only site of change and imperfection. There seems to be a very old need in humans to imagine a perfect, permanent place or person, be it heaven or God or the supposedly unchanging heavenly bodies. Now, on the one hand, when we look at this today, Aristotle's Earth-centered universe seems very reasonable. Mathematicians at the time calculated, for instance, that the Earth must be stationary or else the background of stars would move differently. If the Earth was in motion, then the stars would have to be impossibly far away. And that clearly wasn't true. Of course, now we know that they are, unimaginably, at least to me, far away. But Aristotle didn't have the tools to guess that the universe was so unreasonable. So on the one hand, it makes sense. On the other hand, I used to assume that primitive scientific theories were just the easiest way for people to explain their experience. But Aristotle's system, I've just given you a thumbnail of it, it's actually torturously complex. Because Aristotle knew that it wouldn't explain the movements of the planets. So to these perfect spheres to which the planets were attached, he added perfect circles that the planets made along those spheres. And then 2 centuries later, Ptolemy came along and said, well, they're still not right, and he added more spheres to that. So it's kind of this very crazy system. The Earth-centered theory was not just the best guess that could be made at the time. Rather, it was more like what happens when you're talking with someone and you throw out an idea and the other person points out maybe a problem with what you just said. And at that moment, you must choose one of two paths. You can rethink what you said and admit to yourself and to others that you were wrong. Or you can spin more and more elaborate justifications of why you're right, despite logic, despite history, despite other people's experience, despite even the evidence of your own senses. So I'd like us to keep in mind those two paths and how often we choose the wrong one as we judge these early arguments about the makeup of the universe. Because I don't know about you, but I choose the bad path quite a bit. Galileo was born in this Counter-Reformation era in 1564 to a respectable but not wealthy family. His father was a musician and a composer and a member of a musical movement in Florence that was inspired by ancient Greek myths and dramas. And this movement sought to challenge current musical styles and theories, and it helped lead to the development of opera. Now, his father, Vincenzo, rejected prevailing harmonic theories and church modes, and he explored new tunings and key systems by experimenting with weighted strings to discover new harmonic laws. And these were probably the first experiments that Galileo was involved in as a boy helping his father. Throughout Galileo's life, his father never really encouraged his pursuits, probably because Vincenzo died before Galileo made any money from them. But his father's example, I think, was no doubt important to making Galileo a person who would question authorities, who would question common wisdom, and who would pursue knowledge for himself through experiment instead of just accepting what everybody believed. Like many children of that time from respectable families, Galileo was educated at a monastery, and he so enjoyed the contemplative and intellectual life there that at 15 he told his father that he planned to become a monk, at which point his father decided that he had been at the monastery too long, and he went and brought his son home, because monks really don't make any money. Galileo next entered the University of Pisa to study medicine, which was not a particularly scientific discipline back then. And while at the university, he became fascinated with mathematics, which was actually a branch of medicine, and it was used to cast the horoscopes of patients, which were a major diagnostic tool. And these horoscopes were based on Ptolemy's Earth-centered universe. Now, Galileo's family ran out of money before he could finish his education, and he left school to become a math tutor. But then 4 years later, he returned to the university as a lowly professor of mathematics. And two stories from his days at the University of Pisa, I think, foreshadow his future. One is the famous experiment in which he dropped balls of different weights at the same time off the Leaning Tower, because he wanted to challenge by experiment Aristotle's theory that objects of different weights fall at different speeds, which again seems reasonable, but happens to be wrong. So Galileo went up and said, "Let's find out," and he dropped these two balls at the same time, and they landed not simultaneously because of air resistance, but close enough to convince Galileo that he had been correct, but not close enough to convince his critics that Aristotle was wrong, which I think shows that when results are at all ambiguous, we see what we want to see. In 1971, when astronaut David Scott stood in the near vacuum of the moon atmosphere and dropped a hammer and a feather, they did land at the same moment. And you can actually see that video online, which is pretty interesting if you've never seen it. The other story from that time is that Galileo was fined for refusing to wear an academic gown, which was one of the rules for university professors. He found it pretentious and awkward. But he not only refused, he wrote an essay ridiculing the gowns and the rule. I really was going to give you guys a break from our theme of communication this week, but maybe it's because I have a hammer and I see everything as nails, but I kept seeing these things where I thought, oh, maybe some ethical communication would have helped here. And I don't know if Galileo tried a more diplomatic route first to discuss this issue of the academic gowns, but I think probably not, because throughout his life, as we'll see, part of the not-so-saintly aspect of his personality was that he was often scornful and insulting of those whom he disagreed with or whom he judged as having foolish ideas. Now, as a professor, Galileo taught the accepted theory of the Earth-centered universe, but his letters show that he found more plausible a sun-centered theory that Polish astronomer Copernicus had begun describing a few decades before Galileo's time. But Galileo had no real evidence for or against either view yet. Then around the turn of the century, reports appeared of a new Dutch instrument, almost like a toy, but that used lenses to make faraway things seem near. And Galileo, who had already created new medical instruments, was tremendously excited and threw himself into improving on this idea, for one reason, so that he could do it first and make money. And through trial and error, he built what would soon be known as the telescope. And at first, telescopes were thought of mostly as military tools, actually, so that you could see ships coming while they were farther away, etc. But Galileo soon turned his telescope upward into the night sky. And he made his first discovery as an astronomer, which was that the moon was not perfect, as Aristotle had said it was. Supposedly, its mottled appearance was merely a trick of light, but all heavenly spheres were perfect. But rather, what Galileo saw was that the moon was greatly pitted, and it had these, what appeared to be dry seas and mountains. It looked like a naked earth. And this was revolutionary not just because Aristotle and therefore the church said that the moon was smooth and perfect like a mirror, but that people believed this because of the fundamental place of humanity in the universe and man's relationship to God. People believed that the heavens were created by God sort of as an inspiring work of art, solely for man's visual pleasure, and to tell man's future through astronomy. That was the only reason, clearly, that they were there. Now, the vanity of this notion that the entire universe is simply there for us to think it looks pretty is pretty amazing to us right now, but we know that we are sitting on one planet of one system in a corner of one minor galaxy. And still today, I think there remains a notion that nature exists for our pleasure. Or at least that if we're not getting any pleasure out of nature, then it's irrelevant. It's much easier to get people, for instance, to protect species that are cute or clearly useful to us. Many people don't really see that it matters if one species of bird or snake or fish becomes extinct. There are plenty of others, and who can tell the difference between them anyway? The idea that nature should be allowed to exist for its own sake, that it has a claim of its own, is still not accepted, I think. Even many environmentalists use these human-centric arguments, such as the unknown harm that may befall us if we throw ecosystems out of whack, or that we need the rainforests because we may find unknown medicines there. In many ways, we are still not very far from believing that the universe exists for our pleasure. So Galileo's first disturbing discovery was that for some reason, God had made us an ugly moon. Then he continued to refine his telescopes and increase their power, and his next discoveries were yet more startling. Jupiter had moons that orbited around it. Venus went through phases like the moon did. And the sun was blemished with spots. And all of these discoveries, in one way or another, not only threw out of whack the idea of the perfection of the universe, but they all suggested that the Copernican model was correct. For example, Jupiter and its moons showed that Earth could both have a moon orbiting around it and yet still orbit the sun. Venus's phases only made sense if Venus were orbiting the sun and not the Earth. And at first, church officials were fascinated with the telescope and were open to Galileo's discoveries. After all, many of them were philosophers and scientists themselves. And with the election of Pope Urban VIII, who had as a cardinal, had been interested in the latest science and philosophy and art, Galileo hoped that his discoveries and his now very strong support for Copernicus's theory would get a sympathetic hearing. So he published his book, Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems, in which the Copernican and the Aristotelian universes are debated by fictionalized characters. And the Copernican system is the clear winner. His dialogue did not get a sympathetic hearing. Galileo was eventually called before the Inquisition. He was held at the Vatican. And after several interviews, 7 of the 10 inquisitors found him guilty of suspected heresy for, quote, holding and believing, unquote, that the earth went around the sun. And it's interesting to recall that one of the most hair-splitting issues of that time was that people could discuss Copernicus's theory so long as they did not assert that it was true and did not teach other people that it was true. And maybe this recalls for you the same thing that it recalled for me. And I quote, "This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered." And that, of course, was the sticker that the Dover School District wanted to put on its textbooks until it was found unconstitutional in 2005. Now, after Galileo was found guilty in order to escape torture and imprisonment, or even execution for heresy, which had happened to many other people, he agreed to read a statement in which he declared his faith in the correctness of all official church doctrines and promised never to hold or teach Copernican theory again. His book was banned, and he was placed under various forms of house arrest from then on. What went wrong for Galileo? There are several possible theories. And one is that his discoveries and ideas might have been better received if he had introduced them more diplomatically. The figure in his dialogue who argues for a stationary earth, he named Simplicio. Which, as you can tell, implies fool, and indeed he is made to look a fool in the book. And this angered many influential people, in particular Pope Urban, who supposedly recognized some of Simplicio's arguments as things that he had said in discussions with Galileo before he became pope. And I think it's unlikely that Galileo was foolish enough himself to have meant to make fun of the pope. But one of the problems in making your argument using ridicule and when you're angry is that it often has unintended effects. And at the very least, someone who is feeling attacked and insulted is unlikely to weigh your arguments fairly, which is not to justify the Inquisition, merely to point out one of the lessons that we might learn from his story. Another lesson is the frightening and self-defeating things that people do rather than admit that they're wrong or rather than share power. There's no better way to ensure that your errors will not be corrected than to forbid other people from questioning you and offering alternatives. And this is still another lesson that we're needing to learn. Companies go down in flames, taking hundreds of thousands of pensions with them. Wars get started without exit strategies. People make bad decisions, big and small, every day because we refuse to ask for input or listen when it's offered to us. Luckily, most of us don't have the power to declare ourselves infallible, or when we try, nobody will go along with us. Luckily, we don't have the power to silence others, but we can effectively silence others by refusing to listen with an open mind. And many people today still do have the power to censor those of different beliefs. The book most requested to be removed from libraries and schools in 2006 is called Entango Makes Three, and it's a children's book about two male penguins who care for an egg together. Apparently, this is a threat to our civilization. No doubt based largely on some people's interpretation of the Bible that they see as unchallengeable. Now, it's too easy, I think, to look at Galileo's story as science versus narrow-minded religion, because the idea that the Earth rotated, for one thing, was ridiculous to any reasonable person. We would feel it. The clouds would be whizzing across the sky. I remember when I was a child and I learned that the Earth was supposedly moving at 1,000 miles per hour. I said, that's impossible. So I'm humbled by knowing that if I had been alive in Galileo's time, I would have been one of the people who thought that his ideas were wrong and outrageous. All I can hope for myself ethically is that I hopefully would have believed it was okay for people to have ideas that were wrong and outrageous. But I don't know, and that does keep me humble. One of the hardest ethical questions surrounding Galileo is how are we to think of his decision to recant? We might imagine what we had done in his shoes. We might imagine what might have happened if he had made another choice. Should a person always tell the truth to power and take the consequences? When is it right to live to fight or not to fight another day? How do we decide when it's right to suffer or even die for our beliefs and when it's just a waste? I know in Arthur Miller's play, The Crucible, the last accused witches die rather than name other innocent people. And partly I think they choose to die hoping that their deaths will shock awake the conscience of the silent majority, which in fact it does. Perhaps if Galileo had not recanted, it might have forced a crisis that would have helped both science and the church, but there's no way for us to say. And there was no way for him to have known. His trial did begin a scientific descent for Italy so that it lost its place in the forefront of the intellectual life in Europe. Galileo continued to work in less dangerous areas, but his last great work, which was on mechanics and motion, was smuggled out and was published in Holland. Some people today, I know, have a fear that the various movements to block stem cell research in this country will lead states such as Missouri or even the whole United States to suffer a similar fate of being left behind as science progresses elsewhere. And again, we can't really know. But we do know that the church clearly hurt itself far more than it did its enemies or the beliefs that it feared in the long run, because the Inquisition is infamous even centuries later when it hasn't existed for centuries, while every school child learns about Galileo and his discoveries. Unfortunately, we have still not learned that censorship and threats and violence and torture are not effective methods for winning over hearts and minds. Overall, I just want to say that Galileo's greatest lessons for us are clearly scientific. His observations, his theories, his bravery in exploring the unknown, the instruments that he created or improved, his lifetime of service to forwarding human knowledge. And his mistakes and those of his critics also illustrate the weaknesses of humanity: hubris, egotism, fear of new ideas, fear of loss of power and influence, and they illustrate how dangerous we can be when we succumb to our weaknesses. We can hurt each other, we can hurt our own causes, we can even hold back the progress of humanity. And so I think that a person whose life can remind us of all that is worthy of ethical sainthood, no matter how human he was. Thank you.
You have been listening to a platform address presented to the Ethical Society of St. Louis by Kate Lovelady on 11 November 2007.